best clinicians are not the people who failed the least, they're the people who failed the most, but then they did something about it.
Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. We are in season three, and to kick off the season, we have Andy Bell and Matt Stainer. And so what we're going to chat about today is something that's a little bit abstract, something a bit different that not many people have come across, but hopefully to open up your minds to something completely different. So I'll get Andy and Matt to introduce themselves.
Thanks for having us, Alex. This is really, really exciting, and it's just so cool to have something like a student paramedic podcast out there. So, really looking forward to this conversation, and thanks for having us. So my name's Andy Bell. I'm a lecturer in paramedicine at the University of Southern Queensland. I am a PhD candidate. I'm about, two-thirds, hard to know with a PhD, two-thirds of the way through, let's call it that, on a PhD looking at the paramedic education paradigm and just, you know, how do we make better paramedics, I guess, is kind of the crux of all of that. I have a background of 14 years in the ambulance service in Queensland. I also work for a number of private providers, and I work in the tactical medical space as well, working with special things. And in the more recent years, I've been publishing and have now been looking into this world of operator readiness. Cognitive readiness is obviously where Matt and I start to cross over, which is really interesting. How do we think? How do we act? How do we make paramedics behave in a better way? How do we make better decisions and all of that sort of stuff? So it's all pretty exciting. So, yeah, that's just, I guess, me in a bit of a nutshell.
Fantastic. And Matt?
I'm sort of the opposite end of the spectrum in terms of paramedic experience in that I have none. But my background is in psychology, cognitive psychology. So did my undergraduate degree in the University of Abertay Dundee, did a PhD in Dundee, and then sort of moved around the world a few times to explore various positions. So my background and my interests are really in decision making, but particularly with a use of eye tracking methodologies. So trying to understand why people make the decisions that they make based on where they've looked, because we know there's this tight connection between the visual information coming in and also the behavioral output going out. And it's a nice connection to explore because people don't necessarily know about those things. Sometimes people will report on behavior being very instinctive and they just get a sense of these things happening. Whereas we look at the eye tracking, we can sometimes see some really systematic differences. For example, between novices and experts, which can be very useful because we can use that to try and train novices in expert decision making and clinical reasoning skills. My path crossed with Andy because I just happened to meet another paramedic, Sonny Whitfield, who was getting an award somewhere that I was at, and got talking to him, and he said that there was some stuff happening in fidelity simulation. And met Andy at the first day of testing for that, where I was there with my eye tracker and he was there with his expertise and students. And then just seemed to have found some common interests across there.
That's great. And I guess that's how we all met in terms of getting into studies and having your eyewear, Matt. And yes, Andy, your expertise with students. So what we're going to talk about today, you guys are going to talk about, and I'm going to sit back and learn and can't wait to listen, is about the sort of the interconnection between this eye tracking and the world of paramedicine. So I'll leave you guys to it if you guys want to introduce pretty much what it's about and that origin story.
This is probably the opportunity for you, Matt, to talk about a gorilla, I reckon. It's probably a good place to start. What do you reckon? We'll go from there.
Why not? Yeah. So I didn't want to be an experimental cognitive psychologist. That was never the plan when I went to university. So I was going to go and be a forensic psychologist. My undergraduate degree was in forensic psychobiology, which is a combination of a few different areas thrown together. And I thought I wanted to go and be, Clarice Starling speaking to Hannibal Lecter. And that was what my plan was. But about year three of my studies, somebody showed me this video of these, you know, two groups of three throwing a basketball between themselves in front of an elevator. Yeah. Lift, elevator. That's the same thing, right?
Yeah.
We go from the first hurdle. And they're throwing the ball around, and the idea is that you're meant to count the number of passes that go between them. And so many people have seen this video now, but what happens halfway through the video is that a gorilla walks through the frame, stops in the middle, beats his chest, and walks off the other side. It's a famous study by Dan Simons and Chris Chabri, and before that, some work done by Neisser and Becker. And the nice thing about this demonstration is that around 50% of people who are not expecting to see the gorilla will miss the gorilla walking across the screen. And I was one of those people. And I was sort of equal parts fascinated and infuriated by it. I went and spoke to my lecturer afterwards because it suddenly just changed the way I thought about vision and perception, really, is that it's actually, you know, vision is kind of, someone referred to it a long time ago as the grand illusion, because we've got this idea that everything in front of us is available for our immediate cognitive awareness. But actually, this is a really nice demonstration of the failures of visual attention, and that we don't necessarily process everything that's in our visual field. In particular, something that you would expect to see, and most people do say they would, you know, they would believe they would detect a gorilla walking across. So I really got into vision and perception because of that reason, is that I just found this real interest in how is the experience of vision so different from the information going in. And that sort of led me towards trying to understand human behavior through just looking at visual selection, looking at the things that people look at. The role I think it has in things like paramedicine, but also broadly across medical education, is that you can use it to understand decision-making in a way that is not immediately available to the observer. So if you ask people what they do, for example, cricket batsmen is a nice example. In a nice study by Mike Land and McLeod, they looked at where batsmen looked when they were having a ball bowled towards them. And the batsman, the expert batsman, would report that they believe that they just tracked the ball. They watched it moving towards them. What they actually found was they made this anticipatory movement ahead of the bounce point. So experts are not necessarily able to tap into their processes of visual selection, but it does tell you something very systematic and very strategic. So I think that's really, really interesting. And I think that's one of the areas where I've certainly found that eye tracking has taken me in lots of different directions, and I've been able to work with people in aviation and people in driving and CCTV, and I've done some stuff on people reading x-rays and things like that. And I guess, yeah, so my core interest and the reason that I think we've crossed over with paramedicine is just the idea of trying to tap into those decision-making processes when people aren't really able to tell you about them, but their eyes are really revealing.
Yeah, and for me, what you've just summed up at the end there, Matt, is critical, because really, at the end of the day, what is paramedicine? It's a collection of decisions. Some decisions are quite small, you know, whether or not you use a red pen or a blue pen, whether or not you use the blue gloves or the green gloves. Some decisions are effectively, you know, not really worth considering, or they're just part of the everyday. All the way up to those decisions which have an impact on something like the ability for somebody to actually survive an incident, you know, whether or not it's the decision to either use a drug intervention or not use the drug intervention, or use a particular dose or not to give a dose. But the reality is that paramedicine is effectively just a series of decisions, and those decisions are compounding. And what we are starting to learn is that as we make those decisions, the previous decisions will have an impact on the quality of the decision-making we have moving forward. And this is where Matt's work with the eye tracking and things is really, really interesting, because what we're starting to be able to see and what we're starting to be able to measure is how well someone may make a decision based on where they're looking. And Matt, please correct me if I'm wrong, but really where we're going with this is this idea that whenever we make a decision, really what we're doing is we're choosing between two or more variables, right? Because eventually we're going to get to the point where we have one variable, and that's the decision we choose to make. So the more things we look at, the more variables we have to choose from. So while we start to move towards this idea of pruning down towards a single variable of which we will then make that decision, we are taking things out. We're pruning variables away. And this is where we're starting to see some really interesting stuff because, you know, sort of intuitively, you might think that a paramedic who sees more will make better decisions, but that might not necessarily be the truth. Is that correct, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you see is expertise tends to be kind of more reflected in looking at the right place at the right time rather than just looking everywhere. And I think, you know, the way you talk about decisions is correct. And the fact that, you know, at some point you make a decision, but actually before you've done that, you've information gathered. And what seems to happen when experts make decisions is that they pattern match, is that they match the current situation to previous situations that they've encountered. And that a lot of decision making may be made on the basis of integrating the things that you've looked at. So, you know, you're basically like a little evidence seeker and you're going, you know, your eyes are moving around the world trying to find evidence to support your decision. But we don't necessarily, so the eyes are driven cognitively, but we're not necessarily aware of them, which is this really weird of cyclic loop almost. But what we can do is we can start to look at the places that people look before they make a decision and try and think, well, what does that tell us about their ability to discern relevant from irrelevant information, for example? So if, you know, you've got a decision to make, and Andy, you'll probably want to put this in terms that are more sort of paramedic based. If you've got a decision to make and you've got six different things you could look at, knowing which ones are important and when to look at them as well, because there are some things that might be important now, but not later, and things, those kind of decisions are really important because actually, you know, you've got all of these little decisions about where to get information before you make the big decision about like some sort of treatment course or, and yeah, forgive me if I use incorrect terms throughout because I am.
No, Matt, look, you're correct, but I think one of the things that we need to pay attention to is the fact that there isn't really such a thing as a large decision. There's just a whole collection of smaller ones. If we use the snowball analogy, one small decision is then collected by to another, to another, to another. So what we see is a large outcome. Let's use a patient care model. Let's say we choose to either defibrillate or not defibrillate a patient. Yeah, that's a pretty big outcome. If we choose correctly and it works, and it doesn't always work, and we know that. But if it does, hey, awesome, awesome outcome. But what if we choose not to? We could still actually get a positive outcome, or maybe it's still the right decision because not all, as you know, students, paramedics, you'd know, not all rhythms should be shocked, right? Just because they're in cardiac arrest doesn't mean we should be shocking them. But the decision to defibrillate, while it sounds like this one single big decision, is actually built on a series of much smaller decisions based on, just like Matt's been talking about, our ability to gather information and assess. So for things like the decision to whether or not we shock, we need to have an understanding of things like, well, what is a shockable rhythm? In order to understand what a shockable rhythm is, we have to have an understanding of what is an ECG. If we have to have an understanding of what is an ECG, we have to understand how the electrophysiology of the heart works. And we go back from there. So yes, we make this one big decision. Do we hit the big red button on the defib to say zappy, zappy or not? But that zappy, zappy has been built on a whole series of much smaller decisions to get to that point. Again, all of those are variables being pruned to that point. So we might look at an ECG on a screen and we'll see a series of squiggly lines. And in our brain, we need to decipher whether or not that squiggly line is a squiggly line that we need to zappy zappy or not. In order to do that, we have an understanding of what each of those ups and downs mean within that squiggly line, et cetera, et cetera. So I might look at it and go, all right, it's going this way or it's doing this thing. And therefore, I am not going to shock this patient. Boom, there's the decision. So when it comes to decision making, when we start to see, and we've been doing some really interesting research in this area, and Matt's been a really important part of that, and we've been finding some incredibly interesting stuff, is we've been able to, and Alex, I know you know this because you've been a part of this, we've been able to watch students with eye tracking on in the middle of high fidelity simulations and watch where they're looking and how often they're looking in real time. And while we're on the behind the two-way mirror, and Matt and myself and the other researchers and things are kind of tucked away and out of the way, we're literally able to watch these students in their high fidelity sims and in real time go, do you know what? This person's really indecisive right now. Or this person is really struggling to make a decision right now. Or even this person's about to probably make a bad decision based just on where they're looking, or more importantly, probably how often they're looking in a number of different areas. Is that, how does that stack up, Matt, in terms of the science?
Yeah, absolutely. It was really interesting being with people with expertise watching the eye tracking, because I just find it, fascinating to see the locations they look at, but I don't really understand the relevance of those locations necessarily. But I think what was interesting to see in you guys is that you knew when they were going to miss stuff and when they were going to catch stuff, and you could almost infer their clinical reasoning skills backwards from the eye tracking, which is an interesting way of doing it. Because I guess a question for you both as a student and a teacher is, how do you teach clinical reasoning skills in paramedicine?
Well, that's actually a really, really interesting question, and it's probably deserving of an entire podcast all on its own. But the understanding of clinical reasoning in paramedicine is still being formed, and I would argue that at the moment, it's not necessarily taught that well. But it's not necessarily taught that well because we don't really understand it that well. Mm. And so what we, I guess, have done traditionally is we've used things like we build with a foundation of knowledge. So you build things like underpinning knowledge of things like anatomy, physiology, pharmacology, psychopharmacology, all that sort of stuff, right? We use that as a basis, because without that, you can't start to make any kind of, educated decision. Mm. From that, we then pass it through a filter of systems, which are essentially ways that we are able to manage large scale input of data, so variables. So, the primary survey is really nothing more than an ability to take a large volume of data and process it very, very quickly, which is, in fact, decision making in its purest form, right? Mm. So critical thinking or clinical decision making, they're kind of intertwined, is really the use of an underpinning or foundational basis of knowledge on which we through which we pass a series of filters, which are the systems in which we gather the information. From that, we effectively come up with what we believe is the best case scenario, which might be some form of differential diagnosis. We then implement some form of management or some kind of intervention based on that assumption. All right, now it's an educated assumption, but it's still an assumption. Because we don't definitively know. It's very, particularly in the paramedicine environment, in the unscheduled environment of healthcare, which is paramedicine. It's very difficult to be very definitive about our decision making, because we often, we don't have like they have in, say, those of you who have been to hospital would know that when you go in there, you end up with blood tests and MRIs and CT scans and ECGs and X-rays and everything else. Meanwhile, we're on the side of the road with a thermometer, a blood glucose thing, and a stethoscope. So, we're basing our information and our decision making on what is a fairly limited amount of information coming in. So, again, if I go back to the original question, how do we define or teach critical thinking? We build foundational knowledge. We build systems through which you pass that foundational knowledge. We define or we work out ways that allow us to create some kind of diagnosis type script. We apply management pathways to that, and then we reassess. We find out whether or not the decisions we made were either had a net positive or a net negative outcome, sometimes maybe a neutral outcome. And then we make a decision, probably to gather more data because we need more information, or maybe revise the foundational information that we've passed it through. So it might be that we have to revise our understanding of a particular patho. Maybe we thought it was something, but it's not. Maybe we thought a particular pharmacological intervention would do something, but it didn't. So therefore, we need to reassess, we need to revise, and then we need to make some kind of change, whether or not it's a positive or a net negative. That is essentially critical thinking or clinical decision making. Mm. Now, teaching it's a whole nother level. Alex, what are your thoughts on that? I'd be really interested to hear a student's perspective.
Well, from my perspective, I've had both nursing and paramedics. So from the nursing, we've always been drilled into us. We have a clinical reasoning cycle. And from day dot, it's quite literally that sort of experiential learning sort of theory, I guess, where you take in all these cues. They give you a step-by-step sort of algorithm. And then it finishes off with, that reflective process of, has what I've implemented based on all the information gathered worked, or do I need to get better? You know, what can be done better next time? And recently, from the paramedic perspective, it's that same thing. I guess it is that the good thing about these degrees is that we have that experiential learning. So we learn it theoretically, like you said, in NAT and phys. And then we actually go on placement and we try and incorporate all of the things we've learned into putting it into practice on an actual patient, and building that over time. And again, reflecting, did that work? Did it not work? Where can I go better? And so I guess I haven't really thought of how you build better clinical reasoning in a sense. I think it's just constantly come from, I guess, a trial and error of, I've learned something new, put it into practice, reflect and get better, or that worked well, can do it again in the future. So I haven't really thought of it completely in, I guess, the same depth that you're talking about, Andy, but absolutely, like, that just that experiential learning sort of theory that we've come across.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's important to remember that paramedicine is an applied profession. You know, we're not a theoretical profession. You know, we're not theoretical physicists or cognitive psychologists with like a theory up in, you know, we are people who do our thing. And if we don't do our thing, then we're not really what we call ourselves. Do you know what I mean? So paramedicine, without the applied nature of paramedicine, is kind of not really a thing. So it's really interesting that you've said that, Alex, but really what you've described there is this idea of reflective learning. And I love the fact that you use the term reflective, because at the end of the day, if you don't reflect on your learning, you're not actually learning. That's not a thing. Now, sometimes your reflection shows that, man, I really sucked at that. And that's a good thing. And I need to learn. And sometimes you reflect on it and go, you know what? That was pretty good. I'm pretty comfortable, but I still could have done better on this, this, and this. Now, where was the holes? Where was the gaps, et cetera? What I think is perhaps a bit of a myth, but I'd really like to throw this one over to Matt, is just because someone has more experience doesn't necessarily make them an expert. And the example I will use is, if someone is taught to tie their shoelace wrong and then they practice it 10,000 times, they're still tying it wrong. They're just really, really good at tying it wrong. And I think that's really interesting. And so part of this, and what we're looking at here and where Matt's work is super exciting, is that we're able to drill into the real specifics to the point where, you know, while we're doing these research projects, when a student is, for example, doing their drug check on an ampule, we can actually see whether or not they're looking at the drug and whether or not they're actually reading the ampule, or whether or not they're just literally making it up as they go along. And so for my mind, it's about this idea of high quality, deliberate, reflective practice. That's, for me, what creates someone a really high quality critical thinking and clinical decision making. Matt, does that align with your sort of side of things?
It does. I would argue, though, when you say that paramedics and cognitive psychologists are different, I actually think what we do is pretty much exactly the same in terms of, if you think about the scientific cycle of doing science, is that we start with a theory, generate a hypothesis, which we test, we gather evidence, then we update our theory, and we just start with a new thing. I mean, that's exactly what you guys do with decision making, right? Is you start with an idea, you try stuff, you know, you test it, then you gather evidence, did this work, did it not work? Because I think really that kind of actually nicely captures decision making generally. So I think all of that is about, I'm making the best guess with the information I have available. I'll try things out and I'll update my belief system based on that, and I'll just continue to cycle through that until, you know, we get, you know, some sort of outcome at the end. So I actually think there is a lot of commonalities between those things. In terms of thinking about clinical reasoning skills is that I guess the reason I ask is because I do think it would be such a challenging thing to teach, because just because of that feeling of it being instinctive. And like you say, I think experts, when they've had more experience, they typically do report more confidence in their decision-making processes, whether or not it's right or not. You know, who knows, but certainly more confidence in that decision-making because they just have a bigger bank of experiences and the possibilities. So probably what they're able to do is, you know, if you take a single point in time and you project out into the future, is that actually the further out in the future you get, the number of branches there could be means there are more and more possibilities of things happening. Is that probably what experience does, just narrows that cone of possibility into the future. So actually you're able to rule out some things happening and you're sort of able to maybe chart the trajectory and make better predictions into the future. But clinical reasoning is really, really tough. And one of my interests in that area is because if you can use eye tracking to understand, and I'm looking at eye movements to understand the clinical decision-making processes, can you use that to teach? Because maybe if the eyes are doing something that you can't explain, can that really add to the clinical reasoning information you teach? And they've been doing this with nurses. So it was a nice paper by Hauske Jurodska in 2012, where they brought in something called eye movement modeling. And what they were doing was showing the eye movements of experts, and Jurodska's not the only people to do this, but they were showing the eye movements of experts searching for signs of infant seizures. And what was really interesting about it is that when you then play back the eye movements of the experts, there's a little moving window across the display, and you get the person to describe their decision-making process. That seems to have a benefit in terms of teaching people to then use those skills in other scenarios, because what you're then doing is you're talking about your decision-making processes, but also your eyes are showing the information gathering process. So it taps into something a little bit about, well, you know, if an expert looks at something and goes, I think it's that, that sounds amazing. It sounds astounding that they can do that. But actually, if you understand the steps behind it, it's maybe less miraculous, but also that's easier to teach, because then if you can kind of understand those processes and introspect on them. So I think, you know, I think there's potential for this kind of thing to be used with students as well, if they're looking back at their own eye tracking to try and reflect on their own decision-making processes. And it was really interesting, Andy, when you were talking a student through that process and sort of saying, here's where you were looking, what were you thinking about, you know, how aware were you? And he seemed very surprised at his own eye movement behavior, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, look, Matt, I completely agree. And I believe that that's part of where we're going with this in the future. Part of the studies we're doing aren't just, we're not just talking about eye tracking, we're also talking about physiological response. So we're using things called hexoskins. For those of you out there who want to Google that, they're suits that allow us to measure a whole bunch of interesting physiological measures. And you can't hide from your own physiology. So basically, your body, you can't, it won't lie. You can't lie. You know, we can tell when you're sympathetic or parasympathetic. We can tell even from the eye tracking whether or not you're sympathetic or parasympathetic based on your pupil dilation or constriction. So where do I think we're going with this? I honestly think that at the moment we're using it in research, but I think it's going to be part of teaching in the future. Because imagine this, Alex, and I know you've been through, because we used you as a crash test dummy on some of the stuff, and you did a great job. But imagine doing your clinical simulations at uni with a physiological suit, way to measure your physiology along the way, your decision-making along the way. We could then get you to sit down like Matt just described, I did with one of my students, and went, okay, tell me how you felt at this time, because we have it all on video, obviously. And he was like, oh, you know, I felt like this, this, and this. And I said, well, at this point in time, you were doing this and your body was doing this. Now, did that have any impact on the way you were making? Oh, actually, I was pretty stressed at that point in time. Okay, well, that's clearly affecting this. Now, at this point in time, you were looking here and looking there. Why were you doing that? Oh, and so he was able to reflect and say, at that point in time, I really didn't know what I was thinking, because at that point I got lost in my system. I can't remember specifically, but he was saying things like, you know, at that point I didn't really know where to go next. And we can see it, and you can see it on the screen, and you can match it to the physiology, and you can match it to their own subjective psychological assessment of their performance, etc. Now, when we start marrying all that stuff on top of each other around something like, you know, a cardiac arrest simulation, then you're going to be able to, as a student, get a really, really interesting and hugely valuable detailed set of feedback that you are going to be able to integrate into your own understanding and your own learning. And anecdotally, I've spoken to students who have been a part of the research we're working on, and they're saying things like, I felt like I learned more in, say, 20 minutes than I'd learned in, say, hours previously, because I was getting so much feedback. What were your thoughts on that, Alex? I know you've been the crash test dummy, so how would you feel about, you know, universities or training systems or ambulance services running your training using the type of feedback mechanisms that Matt and I have described?
It's a really good question. As you mentioned, yes, I was one of the crash dummies that was testing these things. And what I found that was fantastic was actually being able to see how stressed I really was in the particular scenario that we were doing, which was pretty insane. But it was really great to see that, for example, one of the things that you picked up during our scenario whilst wearing all of this gear was that whenever new bits of information came in, things like our rest rate would increase, our heart rate would increase. Just knowing that little bit of information and knowing how stressed I was going into the simulation and during the simulation and how that affected my performance was really critical, because I reflected deeply on that afterwards and I came out with a lot of great feedback from myself and from other people on how to be better in the future. And so I think having that in university from first year would be fantastic. Not only would it give you indication on how you respond to certain things, but it also give you indication on why you think certain ways or what happens to your clinical decision making when you do get stressed or when some new piece of information comes at you and you have no idea. So I think that'll be very valuable for students, and it comes back to that really important part of utilizing new information and what you've just done and reflecting on it to be better, because ultimately that's what we want to be, is just be better in ourselves for the future.
I think it would also be really nice to be able to track your change across time as well, because it's a nice way of seeing what you've learned and how you've changed as well. So I don't know. I think I'm hopeful this stuff could be really valuable to students, just to sort of, you know, allow them to just think about their learning, sort of the metacognitive stuff, really, and just be even more aware of those things going forward as well.
Yeah, Matt, I completely agree. And Alex, I think it's important that we frame the term student as every single paramedic ever still ongoing, because the reality is that it doesn't matter whether or not you're a first year in first semester at uni, or, you know, you've been in 15 years and, you know, critical care and on a flight, you're still a student, right? You're still learning every time. So I see what Matt's just described there as an ability to be able to map your learning over time and actually see it as, you know, quantifiable data. Imagine being able to do the same scenario over, say, 3 or 4 years and see your performance back measured across that 3 or 4 years. You could see an improvement in things like your ability, stress inoculation. So you talked before about this, hey, we were able to see ahead of time, you know, spikes in your physiological response. So that's a sympathetic response, heart rate, you know, going up, rest rate going up, etc. But imagine if you did the exact same thing we did with you again. Now, you now know, because you just stated it, that you reflected heavily on your performance and you now would be aware of some of the particular choke points or those points that were causing you those specific areas of concern. You are now able to better manage your physiological response. And as we know, if you're better able to manage your physiological response, particularly in this area around your sympathetic response, then you're going to be able to better manage your cognitive ability to manage the inputs that are coming in, et cetera. Because we all know from fight or flight, we've all been there, that when you get overwhelmed, your decision-making just goes out the window, right? That we all know that. So if you have the ability to be able to reflect on, these are the times when I am going to become, or I have been previously, overwhelmed sympathetically, then I'm going to be able to come up with a way. It might be something simple like a box breathing technique. Maybe it might be just some kind of meditative thing. Maybe it just might be something as simple as a cognitive pause, a step back both physiologically and psychologically to go, I need to take a moment here. heart rate comes down, resp rate comes down, brain settles a little bit. Okay, now I can see the decisions more clearly. This is a better decision to make, and I move on. So that's where I see that this is so exciting, because really at the end of the day, and I completely agree with you, Alex, this is all about making better paramedics. It's about making better clinicians. It's about making, you know, better us. And so it's very exciting from my perspective.
And I think the evidence on arousal is that there is a sweet spot, isn't there? It's just, you know, it's like under aroused is not good, over aroused is not good, but somewhere in the middle. And that middle point is probably different for individuals. But, you know, I think having an understanding of where your middle point is, where you're, you know, hyped up enough to fight, but not necessarily too overwhelmed that you're just swinging at everything. So I think, you know, it would be really interesting to see whether or not these kind of things can be useful for people just working out how they optimally function, because I think everyone's going to have a different area. Some people may just function really well at sort of low levels of arousal, and other people maybe actually when they get more pumped up are going to be better. And maybe that's something people can be working on to just try and work out where they're going to function best.
Yeah, because it's important that we remember that it's not just, and this is important for students across the board, right? It's not just about numbers. At the end of the day, a blood pressure on its own doesn't mean much. A heart rate on its own doesn't mean much, particularly if you only get one of them. It's a snapshot in time. What we're looking for is trends, isn't it? We're looking for things like comparisons against historical data, et cetera. So, you know, that inverted U theory that Matt's talking about there, where we're looking for that optimum level of arousal. Well, Alex, we might find after a series of physiological tests that your optimum level of arousal is physiologically lower than mine. You know, you operate really sweetly in this nice little band of you know, a heart rate between here and here and a resp rate between here and here, whereas I maybe run hot, I don't know, and I might be, you know, running at 20 beats per minute higher or something like that. But what's most important, and this is really key, is that it's not just about the numbers, it's about the outcomes of your performance at that number. So, you know, Alex, what we would look for there would be you finding the place where you perform best and then finding a way to keep yourself as much as you can in that zone. You know, and people talk about flow state and zone state and all that kind of stuff. But essentially, that's kind of what we're talking about. We're just looking for a way to measure it and train it. And if we can do that, if you can find a place where you can sit in your sweet spot, in your flow state, and it's this particular thing. Now, the more often you get to that point, the more that both your body and your brain will know when it's in that state. And it will know, hey, this is where I need to be. This is my spot where I'm going to perform really well. And the more often you go there, the more often you'll be able to get there. And the more often you can get there, then the better, you know, outcomes we're going to perform over a period of time. You become a more reliable, more consistent clinician. So, yeah, it's cool. It's cool stuff.
It is definitely cool stuff. So for students out there that are listening, or grads or whoever is at the moment, what would be your takeaways from this research, even though it's in its early stages at the moment, with people that aren't able to access this fantastic technology? How can students start building, techniques or utilizing some of the concepts that you've come up with without access to this particular technology? Would that be, for example, I guess, going through lots of clinical scenarios and just continuously reflecting, see where they need to get better at, or trying to, I guess, ask further questions to people who are those experts in the fields about where they are or what they are thinking when they're trying to come up with a clinical decision? What would that look like?
Yeah, I think the concurrent commentary stuff is really interesting, getting people to talk about their decision-making processes. I think one thing that might be really nice for students to just think about is that if they're watching an expert make decisions and it seems like it's just, you know, instinctive, is that it's probably not. And actually, it's more systematic than that. Even if the person can't necessarily describe it, these decisions are based on something. It's just that they might not be able to necessarily describe those steps to you. So I think that could potentially be overwhelming to people who just think, oh, but I don't feel that instinctive about it. Is that probably it's a case of over time, those kind of processes will come. So I think to me, it's that decisions are not random, even though they may seem kind of random and instinctive and off the cuff, is that good decisions are built off of evaluation of evidence, comparing it to previous states and things like that. And that's why I think getting as much experience as you can, getting experience in stressful situations which are going to be similar to what you might encounter in the real world, and opening yourself up to that kind of learning, I think would be really valuable. That's certainly from my point of view.
Yeah, I completely agree. I'll come back to that statement I made before about deliberate high quality practice. Now, you know, this is a problem because I've seen this over and over and over again with students in clinical, you know, in labs and things at university and in ambulance services as well. This is not a university problem. This is across the board. You will, there's that old sporting adage that you'll perform to the level at which you practice. And it's true. So if you practice and you're mucking around and it's all ha ha and laugh, laugh and blah, blah, blah. And now it's okay to be chill, sure. But when you get to the position that you're in this for real, you're not going to be chill and you're not going to be joking with your buddies and slapping them on the back and telling a joke about whatever, right? You're going to be literally having your, you know, butt hanging out. And if you haven't been in that position with your butt hanging out, then you don't know what it will feel like and you don't know how your body will respond to it. So you're probably more likely to make a poor decision. I'm not saying you will, I'm saying you're more likely to, because this is all about percentages, really, of chance. You know, how often do you, every time you make a decision, there's a chance you're going to make the wrong one, yeah? So practice is key, but deliberate practice is key. High quality deliberate practice is key. So whether or not you're using, you know, super high tech stuff and eye tracking and everything else, and I would like to clarify, Alex, that it's, you know, this is not my idea. This is not Matt's idea. This is a collection of lots and lots of researchers and lots of areas bringing little pieces to the table, and it's all kind of being pieced together at the moment. And there's still a long, long way to go. But what's really exciting for us in paramedicine is it hasn't really been tapped, and now's the time. And we've got some really, you know, outstanding researchers in the field. People like Dr. Sandy McQuarrie at Griffith. He's doing a fantastic work in this area. And Matt himself, also from Griffith and things, you know, we're on the cusp or on the way on the cusp of a wave of really, really cool opportunities to learn. But I think more importantly than anything else, it's about intrinsic self-reflection. If you don't actually take a good hard look at your performance, if you just go, oh, that was good, but was it? Or you just go, it was good enough, because it got me to pass my OSCE, or it got me to, like, you know, get the 50% in that assessment to get me over the line, then is that good enough? Is it? Is 50% good enough? Because 50% right is also 50% wrong, right? Now, that's basically a coin toss. Now, I don't know about you, but if you're operating on one of my, you know, loved ones, I don't really want you coming in and tossing a coin to make a decision on whether or not they're going to live or die. I'd really like you to be probably slightly better than that. So at the end of the day, the only person who can own your learning is you. And if you, whether or not we put all these suits on you and glasses on you and we give you all this data or anything else, it's just data. Again, it's just numbers. It doesn't really mean anything until you do something with it. And doing something with it is processing it through your own lens, making decisions about your own performance, with the input of experts and, you know, people that can give you some feedback and everything else. But at the end of the day, did you do that as well as you possibly could have? If you didn't, then how can you improve? That's up to you. And I think every student can do that, right? We can all do that. Yeah.
Just asking yourself the question, why did I do that? I think would probably really help there, Andy. That seems like, you know, it's not just what decision did you make, but why, and thinking about those kind of things as well. Because it didn't come out of nowhere, but actually being more in tune with your own decision-making processes will probably just be really useful.
Do you think, Matt, that it's just the fact that you're aware of your decision-making is a good place to start?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's something we can be, you know, reflecting on. It's not just like, did I get it right, but why did I go down the path that I did, and those kind of, you know, more fine-grained detail about not just being results-oriented, but also thinking about the decisions that led you to that point. And I don't, like, I completely agree. I don't think you need eye tracking. I don't think you need any of that. just chuck your camera on and film it and just be like, watch it back and be like, why did I do that at that point? You know, those kind of things are, you know, very accessible now. So did I just say phones are accessible? That feels like a...
It's a little bit like, obvious. You know, yeah, I thought my golf... I basically thought I was Tiger Woods until I recorded myself and then I realised I'm really not Tiger Woods at all. So, do you know what I mean? It doesn't take much to take a good hard look at yourself. You just got to be honest about it. And the quality of your outcomes and your decision making.
Absolutely, that was fantastic. Before we sign it off, is there anything that you guys wanted to add that you feel like you've missed or would just love to share as a final point?
I would just say that I've had an absolute blast working with the paramedics, is that you guys are all good fun, just seem to be really sort of in it for the right reasons and things, and just open. People are sometimes cautious when you say you're working in decision-making because people think you want to see why I'm doing it wrong. And that really isn't my interest and never has been. My interest is, can we make things better and can we understand ourselves a bit better? And everyone I've encountered in paramedicine has been absolutely open to those ideas, has been willing to engage in the conversation and stuff. And it's been an absolute pleasure, as has this conversation.
Yeah, that's cool, man. Look, from my perspective, all I would like to add is, the best clinicians, whether or not they're paramedics or doctors or whoever it might be, the best clinicians are not the people who failed the least. They're the people who failed the most, but then they did something about it. So when you talk to those paramedics at the tip of the spear, the HARU level, the highest level, that you know, your critical cares, your flight paramedics, they'll tell you that they've failed 1,000 OSCEs. They'll tell you that they've failed 1,000 clinical exams, because they have. And they'll also tell you that they're scared witless when there's something that they've never seen before that they're now having to deal with. But they've got to that level because they haven't then allowed those times to go pop by. They've used that time. So if you want to be a really great clinician, then first and foremost, you're going to have to fail, because success is built on failures, pretty much. Own the failures, learn from them, and improve, and that's it. Happy days.
That's fantastic. I guess that's the perfect way to end this. And just for all the listeners, I'll pop in the YouTube clip of the gorilla in the show notes so they can all go check it out, and you'll be very surprised.
I mean, it's going to work now, Alex.
It won't work now. That's the problem. Although there is a twist.
No, there is a twist. Because I thought the same thing. I was like, I know it now. Why watching this is, you know, how is this going to help me? But you'll be sorely, you're surprised. So thank you so much, guys. Is there any ways that you, particularly for you, Andy, if students want to contact you, or Matt, if you've got any sort of papers out there that people want to read, is there any ways that our listeners can learn more?
Yeah, I've had some papers out in things like CCTV surveillance. My work with paramedicine is really new, so hopefully there'll be new stuff out in the next year in terms of speaking to me and things. I don't have any social media. I have a really dead Twitter account, which I tried for a while, but just couldn't. I didn't have the energy. I'm too tired. So, yeah, just email if you have any questions, I guess.
Yeah. Look, this is, you know, early days in this space, so... there hasn't been a lot published here yet, but it is coming, and there will be an avalanche of it, I can promise you, in the next couple of years. I do have a bunch of papers out more around educational methodology and understanding of how we learn and why we learn, and what perhaps is the best way for us to start learning. And you can find me, I guess, on Google Scholar and things as Andy Bell, Andrew Bell. I do have a Twitter account, which I'm terrible at, which is Paradub. And I'm on LinkedIn as well, just as Andrew Bell. And I'd love to hear from you there, because there's a lot of really cool stuff that we can share in that space. But if you do want to touch base and any of this interest, actually, if there's any interest in the research space and you want to talk about it more, you can get a hold of me at USQ. It's andrew.bell@usq.edu.au. But Alex, I just wanted to say thank you so much for the opportunity. And for having us along today. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I think you're doing a fantastic job in disseminating knowledge, so please keep up the good work.
Thank you to you both for sharing your time and your knowledge. I really appreciate it. And we'll sign it off there. Thanks to our listeners for listening to the first episode of season 3. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or you can email us at thestudentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com.